From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is some of the most controversial legislation to emerge in the post-9/11 era. And today in Washington, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez urged Congress to renew it almost in its entirety.
In my judgment, the Patriot Act includes a lot of safeguards that critics of the act choose to ignore. They don't talk about the safeguards that do exist in the act. I think they, as I said before, reflect a very careful balance between the security of this country and the protection of our civil liberties. And for that reason, we wholeheartedly support the renewal of the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act, passed while the rubble of the Twin Towers still lay in Lower Manhattan 3.5 years ago, sharply expanded the American government's surveillance and prosecutorial powers. 15 of the Act's provisions will expire in December unless Congress renews them. Supporters say any but the slightest pullback would be a mistake. But criticism of the Patriot Act now comes from both sides of the political spectrum, right and left, in what is becoming an increasingly diverse opposition. Today, Democratic Illinois Senator Richard Durbin stood shoulder to shoulder with conservative Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho in calling for changes that would rein in the Patriot Act. Here is Republican Senator Craig.
We do not take away the powers of surveillance. We do not take away the right and the power of the government to go after those who would do us wrong. What we do condition in a very real way is that the government might intrude upon or choose to intrude upon the rights and the privacies of free citizens of our country. And that is a basic American principle, a right that we will not walk from, nor should we cower from for the sake of security. That's what this debate is really all about.
There will be months of congressional hearings in this new landscape of opposition. Today, they began. We'll listen in tonight on Point, the new debate over the Patriot Act, the arguments of its defenders, and why it's under fire from critics on the left and the right. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time to rethink the Patriot Act, to rein it in, or to make its provisions permanent? Do you feel differently now about the balance between fighting terrorism and preserving civil liberties than you did when Congress passed the Patriot Act just 45 days after 9/11? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been covering all the hearings. Gail, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you along.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Gail.
So, Gail, take us into this today. Very interesting. Listening to these hearings, there was plenty of sharp criticism of the Patriot Act. There were supportive statements on the Patriot Act, and there was a lot of other stuff that didn't seem to have to do with the Patriot Act at all. The senators were hungry to kind of get their hands on Alberto Gonzalez and the head of the FBI, Mr. Mueller.
Exactly. I think it was one of the most interesting days I've seen on Capitol Hill, mainly because of the diversity of the political coalition that's out on this issue. Dick Durbin called it the most diverse political coalition ever gathered on Capitol Hill. That might be an overstatement, but not by much. To see the ACLU standing shoulder to shoulder with the American Conservative Union, the League of Women Voters, and Gun Owners of America concerned about this bill.
This is not an everyday occurrence. We've heard criticism from the ACLU from the very earliest minutes of this bill's life. What has brought conservatives around to opposition?
Well, you know, if you go back to the bill itself, back in the dark days after 2001, conservatives from the start were concerned about this. That's why they insisted on the sunset provisions for some of the most controversial features. Their concern then and now is that it's not enough to have a government that you trust. You don't want written into law provisions that could seriously encroach on privacy and liberties, because eventually someone's going to use them. So they'd like to see some of these more powerful provisions rolled back at this point, or at least seriously constrained.
Gail, can you give us a sense of the alternate package that Senators Durbin and Craig were talking about today?
They're talking about changing standards and reining in certain provisions. For example, Section 215, which provides proviso orders for the library and other personal or business records is one of the most controversial. People don't like the idea that someone can swoop in and look at what they've been reading or taking out of the library. And that it's interesting how many times the library comes up, because it's an issue that touches many, many Americans. And what they would do, and this was interesting exchange between General Gonzalez and the chairman, Arlen Specter. Mr. Gonzalez said, look, we have only used Section 215 for driver's licenses, apartment leasing records, credit card records, mm-hmm. subscriber information. We have not used it to obtain medical, library, or gun sale records. And Specter asked him, well, then would you be willing to exclude library and medical records from the law? And General Gonzalez said, well, that would be like a policeman who had a gun in his holster for 15 years and never pulled it out. Mm. It shouldn't be held against us that we exercised restraint. And no, we wouldn't support that bill. So that's the kind of exchange that you're going to see as this debate moves on to the floor of the Senate and the House.
There was also a lot of conversation today about Section 213 of the Patriot Act, the so-called sneak and peek provision. We've got sound from today's hearings, and I want to begin to bring it in here. In this exchange, Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold asks Alberto Gonzalez about Section 213. This is the section that allows federal agents to search a suspect's home or property without immediately notifying them that they've been there. Here's Senator Feingold.
I want to clarify a few things regarding sneak and peek warrants that I think have gotten a little confused in the debate. Mr. Attorney General, if the FBI were investigating an international terrorist or spy, it could obtain a secret FISA search warrant and never provide any notice to that person. That's correct, isn't it?
General, yes, sir. No notice under FISA.
And Section 213 has nothing to do with that authority.
That is
correct.
One
way or the other. That's right, isn't it?
That is correct.
So when we're discussing Section 213, Mr. Chairman, we're talking for the most part about searches done to investigate crimes that have nothing to do with terrorism or espionage, right?
It can, but it also includes other kinds of crimes. That's correct, 213.
There's no inherent connection to terrorism vis-a-vis the power in Section 213 of sneak and peek.
That is what Congress intended, when it drafted 213.
And I'm glad we clarified that, because I think many people have a different calculation about the way what they think should be permissible if we're talking about terrorism investigations. So people should be clear that Section 213 sneak and peek is in no way delimited to terrorist situations.
Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold there talking with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez today. Gelchadik, on this issue of sneak and peek and the powers of the Patriot Act bleeding out beyond counterterrorism activity, there seemed to be quite a bit of conversation today. These have been applied far from the so-called war on terrorism.
That's right. And what General Gonzalez also said was Congress intended that. There are other crimes, child abductions and so forth, that we might want to use expanded authority. It was interesting. There was a briefing after the hearing today with the Justice Department where they pointed out that only 0.2% of all search warrants fall under this category of delayed notice, to which critics respond 0.2% is 0.2% too many, and we need to have a lot clearer disclosure on how these are being used, where and under what circumstances. Unfortunately, much of that is going to be at a hearing next week, which is closed to the press and the public. So another dimension to this is going to be pressure from the press and the public to get more information about what are the cases where these expanded powers are being used, and what kind of public disclosure is needed to protect the public from having it go too far.
Jack Beatty, this issue of expanded powers and creeping lines of application, I suppose, is what has brought no small number of conservatives at this point into opposition to the Patriot Act. Very interesting alliances forming here.
Yes, conservatives on issues like this find their roots, which really come down to defending the rights of the individual against the omnipresent, often authoritarian state, or at least interfering state, and these sorts of things, looking at people's library records and other things. This is the sort of thing that for conservatives just is big government writ large. And I think that when we could hear in the background of that of that colloquy that between the senator and the attorney general, laughter. And I think that laughter was from another Democratic senator who was recognizing the absurdity here. I mean, this was a provision in the Patriot Act that doesn't have to do with the avowed purpose of the Patriot Act, precisely the kind of thing that civil libertarians and conservatives warned about, that you put it in for one reason, and it migrates into a general writ that allows people to go after regular criminals.
Senator, Idaho Senator Larry Craig was on that score today when he spoke at the press conference this afternoon outside of the hearings, talking about the Patriot Act and its potential pitfalls. So we'll come to that in a moment. So here we are, Gail. We're going to hear tonight from defenders of the Patriot Act and conservative critic of the Patriot Act. But your sense of Congress and where they're likely to end up with this long trail, it doesn't really, the sunset doesn't happen until the end of December. So there's a lot of time to consider this. Do you see them really getting in here, hammer and tongs, changing this legislation, or more or less going along with Alberto Gonzalez and Mr. Mueller today and saying, let's keep it pretty much steady as she goes?
I think there's a... The Patriot Act will certainly pass in some form. I think the fact that the Attorney General is willing to discuss changes without immediately saying any change is going to cripple our ability to fight terrorism, which is generally how Mr. Ashcroft would respond to suggestions for change. The fact that he's open to it, I think, changes the climate a lot. You've got a bipartisan group of senators and House members interested in talking about it, and I think that is what's going to happen.
Gail Shattuck in Washington, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Jack Beatty, stick with us. We're talking tonight about the Patriot Act back in the spotlight and taking fire from the right and the left. You can join the conversation tonight. Did Congress overreact to 9/11 in the Patriot Act? Is it time to rein in the act's extraordinary powers, or is it just right for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Patriot Act back in the spotlight, taking fire from the right and from the left, getting some support, too. You can join the conversation tonight. When conservatives are up in arms over the Patriot Act, what does that tell you? But on the other hand, does 3.5 years without a domestic terror attack mean the Patriot Act is working? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. There was criticism in the hearings in the Senate today. There was also support. Here, Utah Republican Orrin Hatch defends the Patriot Act by pointing out in questions to Alberto Gonzalez that no one has filed a grievance claiming inappropriate application of the act.
On both of your prepared testimonies, you note that Section 223 of the Patriot Act allows individuals aggrieved by any willful violation of the criminal wiretap statute or certain provisions of the FISA statute to file an action in federal district court to recover not less than $10,000 in damages. Moreover, Section 223 also requires the department to commence a proceeding to determine whether a disciplinary action is warranted against any federal employee found to have violated the wiretap statute. Now, the testimony of the Attorney General states, quote, to date there have been no administrative disciplinary proceedings or civil actions initiated under Section 223 of the U.S. Patriot Act, unquote. First, I want to make sure that I am correct in understanding that no actions have been brought, let alone have been successfully brought under Section 223 in the 3.5 years since the Patriot Act has been on the books. Am I correct in arriving at that conclusion from your comments and your statement?
Your understanding is correct, Senator.
Well, that's fine. Second, what do you think this record shows about how seriously the Department and the Bureau take their responsibilities to protect civil liberties as they engage in activities to identify and prevent terrorist acts?
Senator, I think that that record indicates that we've tried to be careful in the exercise of these authorities. I think it also reflects the fact that I think Congress did a good job in drafting the Patriot Act and in including appropriate safeguards. We take those safeguards very, very carefully. We think they're very, very important, a critical part of the Patriot Act. And so I think that is also reflected in this record.
careful safeguards, the Attorney General said today, and he won some support there from Orrin Hatch in the hearings. Outside, a little trickier situation. Bob Barr, the former Georgia congressman, has been very critical. He's now chair of the Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances. And Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig has been tough as well. He said he supports, says the Patriot Act has made the country safer, but it warns of dangers that it might compromise the rights of free citizens in the country. Let's listen to a bit more of that from Senator Larry Craig.
We are a safer nation today, I believe, because of the Patriots Act. But let us not fail to recognize that those powers were broad. They were done in the heat of frustration and fear. And we want to make sure that those powers are such that they do not be misused in any time and any circumstance that would somehow compromise the right of a free citizen and a law-abiding citizen of our country.
Senator Larry Craig, Republican of Idaho, in Washington at a press conference outside the site of the hearing today. We're joined tonight by a couple of guests, one in support, one in opposition to the Patriot Act. Heather McDonald joins us from New York. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a non-practicing lawyer. She's written extensively on the Patriot Act. You can see some of her writing at our website, onpointradio.org. Heather McDonald, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you.
And joining us from Alexandria, Virginia, David Keene, chairman of the American Conservative Union. He's a member of the board of Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances, an alliance of groups including the American Civil Liberties Union and the American Conservative Union, formed last month to seek changes in the Patriot Act. David Keene, thanks for joining us tonight.
Pleasure.
Mr. Keene, first to you. There has been some lifted eyebrows at the number of conservatives who are now climbing on board to critique this act. Where does your critique begin?
Well, I think first we have to clarify what we're talking about when we say in opposition to the Patriot Act. 97 or 98% of the Patriot Act is essentially non-controversial.
And we heard Larry Craig say that just now.
Right, and it has been from the beginning. The problem, however, is in the other 2 or 3%. The act was sort of cobbled together in the days following 9/11. And you could almost see or in your mind's eye what happened. The president, in the wake of 9/11, turning to the attorney general and saying, what do we do? The attorney general turning to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies and saying, what should we do? And then everybody saying, we've got all of these requests for power, many of which had been turned down in the past, on the shelf. Let's throw them all together. Let's pass them. Congress did it, and Congress would have passed virtually anything at that particular time, as a number of members have pointed out since. And then because a number of members of Congress, not exclusively, but many of them conservatives, said, wait a minute, we should be looking, not cynically, but critically, at any request for government power. Let's sunset some of these provisions, not because we necessarily want to get rid of them at the end of a certain period of time, but because what we need to do is when things cool down, we need to look at the way the act has been written. We need to ask ourselves whether it has been abused or whether it is susceptible to abuse, whether all the powers that have been enacted are needed or whether some of them can be scaled back or, in some instances, whether there need to be more powers granted. And that's what's going on now. When the so-called SAFE Act, which is what the what Larry Craig and Dick Durbin reintroduced today, was first introduced in the last session of Congress, most of us believe that it was important not to have a real discussion until now, when the sunset provisions came in and when we weren't in the heat of an electoral battle where these things were bantered about for political reasons.
And what would the SAFE Act do, David Keene? How would it interact with the Patriot Act?
Well, it would provide some safeguards in a number of the provisions, the so-called records provisions, the
so-called library issue,
library cases, and things of that. As you know, Attorney General Gonzalez, like Attorney General Ashcroft before him, has said, "Well, we've never requested those records, but we might want to." And that language and what's been said there tells you two things. One, I think that those who have suggested that the Justice Department has been relatively careful in its use of the act are correct. But the fact of the matter is that when a law goes on the books which grants government power, whether it's the Justice Department or any other department of government, Most conservatives fear that you ought to be careful because that power, even if it's not being used today, can and will be used at some point for purposes the original authors never envisioned. The example that many conservatives point to is the RICO statutes, which were enacted initially to go after organized crime and
racketeering laws
to stop right-to-life demonstrations. Mm-hmm. So all of these things need to be looked at, and both the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Spector, mm-hmm. and the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Sensenbrenner, have said that they intend to look at these things carefully, as has the Attorney General, who has said that he is willing to look at the need for clarification in certain provisions. He said that today, and that he's willing to discuss all of these things. Let me just for 1 second refer back to the 9/11 Commission report.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
In referring to the Patriot Act, said the burden of proof for retaining a particular governmental power should be on the executive to explain, A, that the power actually materially enhances security, and B, that there's adequate supervision of the executive's use of that power to ensure protection of civil liberties. That's what these oversight hearings are about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this review is about. And your reporter who suggested quite accurately that the Patriot Act is going to be reauthorized with some changes, which from the standpoint of national security will be minor, but which from the standpoint of protecting individual liberties in the future may be very important.
Mm.
That assessment, I think, is exactly right.
Heather McDonald, you're coming at this from a conservative point of view as well. Do you see a gap, or I don't know, even a chasm opened up on the conservative end of the political spectrum about the contents of the Patriot Act? Or would you agree with David Keene that it's 2 or 3% of the act that's in question and needs to be modified?
Well, I see no evidence that there's a need for modification. I welcome this opportunity to debate the act because it has been the subject of the most amazing misinformation campaign that began from the day it was passed, both on the part of the left-wing libertarians like the ACLU and right-wing libertarians like American Conservative Union and Americans for Tax Reform. And the administration, unfortunately, has done an absolutely lousy job of getting the facts out about the Patriot Act, and I sure hope that at this point it is a little more successful and makes a more aggressive effort to inform the public about the fact that this law made absolutely essential changes in the government's power to gather information on terrorist planning, to collaborate, to have all members of the intelligence community connect the dots and share information. And it updated existing powers to take into account the fact that we're no longer using rotary phones, but are in a cell phone and internet age. But the most, I think, powerful strategies that the Anti-Patriot Act coalition that is nothing new. I mean, the fact that the right wing and the left wing blends on this has been the fact for the last 3 years. The two most important rhetorical strategies that they use, Tom, and we can see this in your presentation tonight, is hiding the judge and concealing legal precedent. You will never hear from the Patriot Act critics the fact that judicial review, which is the most important structure in our Constitution for limiting executive power,
mm-hmm.
is pervasive in the Act. None of the search or surveillance powers that the Patriot Act merely updates can be exercised without the executive going before a federal court. The second strategy that is used is concealing legal precedent. You hear from the ACLU or from people like Larry Craig that something like Section 213, the so-called sneak and peek warrant,
mm-hmm.
The possibility of delaying notice of a search. This is inevitably presented as a vast new power granted the government. Nothing could be further from the truth. Courts for decades have acknowledged that delaying notice of a search, and it's merely delayed, it's not denied, it's a delayed for a reasonable period, which is generally considered 90 days, is an essential concomitant of being able to investigate whether it's terrorism or a crime.
So as not to tip off everybody in the criminal circle of what's going on.
You couldn't possibly conduct many kinds of criminal preemptive investigations if you were, let's say, knocking on Mohammed Atta's door and saying, "Sir, we have a warrant here to search your hard drive." Notice is fine if the crime has been committed, but if you're engaged in a preemptive investigation, and what the Patriot Act does, and this merely codifies 2 decades worth of judicial holdings, is to say in certain exigent circumstances, like there's a threat that the target of the search will destroy evidence, or threaten a witness, or kill somebody, or take off, flee himself, you can delay notice of a search. But under this sneak and peek provision, which, as I say, merely codifies existing law, the courts have, the FBI has long been able to do this. The Patriot Act is nothing new. The court has to approve this.
Right. We hear it. So nothing new here, you're saying. I want to get some response. David Keene at the American Conservative Union. A number of things here. First, Heather McDonald says these are essential changes that have been made that I guess she's suggesting that conservatives like yourself have a misinformation campaign, that you're ignoring the fact that there's judicial review and that this is all a matter of legal precedent already.
Well, first of all, much of what Heather says is true in terms of the information sharing and coordination and updating of laws. That's the 97% of the act that nobody particularly disagrees with. In terms of the judicial review, part of the problem is that in many of these cases, in some cases you don't have to go to court. You can do it with a letter from approved by the Attorney General. And secondly, in many cases, what was judicial review has been turned into a purely ministerial act by the judge, who is not allowed to go behind the facts that are presented by law enforcement. So it does, in fact, reduce the role of the judiciary. But let me go to Heather's comments about the so-called sneak and peek powers. It is perfectly true and logical that in some criminal cases, in some circuits, delayed notification searches have been allowed for a long time. In only one set of cases has there ever been a statutory authorization of delayed searches, and those are FISA cases. And in your news report earlier, Russ Feingold of Wisconsin,
yes,
in his exchange with Mr. Gonzalez, raised that question. In terrorist investigations, prior to the passage of the Patriot Act, the United States government and Justice Department already had the authority in terrorist cases under statute to do delayed notification searches. That was never in question. So had the Patriot Act never been passed, they would already be able to do what Heather says they must do. I'll tell you why the Patriot Act was important to this, because first of all, and not in terrorist cases, but as Feingold and Gonzalez both acknowledge in that exchange, but in non-terrorist criminal investigations,
mm-hmm,
the Justice Department was concerned because in some circuits, the circuits looked more kindly on these than in others. In all of them, there was required a set date notification. The Patriot Act made it essentially national and removed the requirement that the Justice Department go back after a certain number of days and put in the reasonableness clause, which made it open-ended.
So kind of clean and empowered from the top.
Now, whether or not that's wise or not, if Heather wants to argue that in the case of something else, that's fine. But that power already existed in terms of national security and terrorist investigations. And one of the problems that we had at the beginning was that I found it very easy to argue that you had to have, under certain circumstances, a lower bar to go in and prevent a terrorist act than you might want to have in terms of rights, for example, to investigate a tax cheat. The problem with what happened here is that these all apply not just to terrorist investigations, but to everything. Within a matter of weeks of the time the Patriot Act was passed, every U.S. attorney in the United States got a letter from the Justice Department saying, remember, the USA Patriot Act is not just a tool to be used against terrorism. It is a tool in your arsenal against all crime.
And there we're off to the races. And I'm Tom Asprey. This is On Point. We'll come back to Heather McDonald and David Keenan just a moment. Jack Beatty, quite a picture painted here. Powers that existed, powers that were sharpened.
Yes, and it slipped. And often, after wars get going, we regret the legislation passed during them. I don't think we've quite reached that point with this whole act, but certainly with parts of it.
Well, we're talking tonight about the Patriot Act. Back in the spotlight, you can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Patriot Act back in the spotlight, taking fire from the right and the left. You can join the conversation tonight. Did Congress act well or overreact to 9/11 in the Patriot Act? Is it time to rein in the Act's extraordinary powers? Do 3.5 years without a domestic terror attack mean the Patriot Act is working? And have you followed the creep of Patriot Act powers from fighting terrorism to confronting more ordinary crime? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from New York by Heather McDonald, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, who's written extensively about the Patriot Act, and from Alexandria, Virginia, by David Keene, chairman of the American Conservative Union, which has raised some significant objections and issues with the Patriot Act, as you're hearing tonight. You can join the conversation as well right now. Clark is calling from Bloomington, Indiana. Hi, Clark. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Thanks good evening. For having me. I want to point out just one small clarification. There really are no liberal or conservative libertarians. They're not left-wing. They're not right-wing. They're just libertarian, fiscally conservative, socially liberal.
Well, we could argue about where the ACLU falls, but we take your point. What's on your mind about the act, Paul? Clark?
Well, I'm probably a poor student of the Constitution, but as I read it, the Fourth Amendment, Fourth Amendment says that all people should basically be safe in their persons and papers, and no inadvertent searches of their home should be undertaken without appropriate search warrants by oath and affirmation before a judge.
So, when Heather McDonald says judicial review is still part of this process, are you comforted?
I'm not comforted if anybody can come into my home and not have to tell me about it.
But what if it was the home of a terrorist?
It's a slippery. I don't care. I fear Alberto Gonzalez more than I do Osama bin Laden.
Why?
Because of civil liberty issues. No, Osama bin Laden can't tax me, can't send me to jail. However, our federal government can for acts that they deem might be a terrorist-related activity.
Or even not
terrorism.
Nothing
to do with terrorism, mm-hmm. Right. It might not have anything to do with terrorism, but fall under somebody's broad categorization or broad paint stroke of definition of terrorist activity, regardless of what that is, that has nothing to do with national security, then it causes a dragnet to bring in people that have nothing to do with terrorism, and then they're deprived of their civil liberties with these indefinite holes in hell holes around the world.
And there's your greater fear. Clark, thanks for your call. Heather McDonald, how about this, the concern that the judicial review here is kind of truncated? A citizen like Clark says, look, this could drift out and be used in ways that were never intended. David Keene raises the same concern.
Well, that kind of radical skepticism about government is healthy. It's our Constitution is based on it. But it's one thing to make a sort of a general charge that government power is always subject to this drift. That's fine. You have to look at what any given implementation or articulation of that power does to make sure that that doesn't happen.
That's why we're here, and the concern is raised that this judicial review is not as complete as some would like.
Well, in the case of sneak and peek, in the case of a delayed notice of search, you need, number one, probable cause to search in the first place. It's an absolutely typical warrant that grants no additional power to government that it already was checked. And to delay notice of a search. And again, let me emphasize, it is not a permanent delay. It is simply temporary for a reasonable period of time. And the court has to find that there is reasonable cause to believe that notifying the subject would lead to such adverse results as witness intimidation, violence, or destruction of evidence. To me, that is perfectly reasonable. And again, the reason that this came about was to try and establish a uniform standard across the country so that when the Justice Department is engaged in complex national investigations, it doesn't have to worry about the minutiae of the Second Circuit versus the Ninth Circuit rulings, and to establish a uniform precedent that basically just codifies and reaches an average of what was already out there.
If this is such a good idea, why was it not in place before 9/11?
Well, I think that there's no question that this was a wake-up call, and it is true, as Mr. Keene says, that there were some changes that were on the books, and Congress didn't really feel itself necessary to move itself to pass them. But the question is, does this deprive us of our rights? And the idea that with judicial review of a power that long existed, we've somehow been stripped of our rights, I simply disagree with that. And it's a gut instinct whether you fear John Ashcroft more than Al-Qaeda. I think that most Americans, if they were properly informed about the layers of judicial review throughout the Patriot Act, would realize that the government has internalized for decades now the notion of limited power in conducting investigations. Al-Qaeda abides by no such checks. Their desire is to destroy as many Americans as possible. The idea that we have a government that is at any given point about to run amok, I think, ignores the last three decades of developments within the Justice Department and the FBI.
But as you say, a radical skepticism is baked in the cake here in the U.S. Constitution, and it's kind of the birthright of Americans. Jack Beatty, you can hear in our callers' concerns the kind of desire among ordinary citizens for very broad, clear protections, not too nuanced, please.
Yes, and you know they have a strong precedent looking back, as I said earlier, on our previous wars. I mean, in the Civil War, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended, the Confiscation Act was passed, seizing the property of southern plantations. These things were immediately changed after the war. In World War I, the Espionage Act made it a crime to even talk against the draft. Eugene Debs went to jail for 4 years under it. And in World War II, of course, there were a number of things, including the Attorney General's list of banned publications, which long survived the war and became a kind of Cold War statute. So, yes, Americans usually regret after wars the passage, things they passed in the heat of war. The trouble with the War on Terror is that there's no end to it. There's no end point. And Patriot 1 could be succeeded by Patriot 2. That's one problem. And the second one is, we haven't had the constitutional scandal with this yet. The constitutional scandal has been at Guantanamo. It's been the way these people have been put into a kind of netherworld, these detainees. And the courts have rightly reproved the administration there. But we haven't had anything quite like that here.
Domestically.
We could. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get one more caller in here, if I may, Heather. Mary's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello. I know people don't like to talk about this, but I would like to mention the fact that the Fourth Amendment comes from the Magna Carta, and one of the rights was, as I read as a freshman in high school, that the king couldn't come in without a search warrant. And I think Americans define themselves, if your home and the books you have therein or whatever isn't safe, I don't think you can say you're an American.
So you're tracking it right back to the Magna Carta and saying, let's keep it there. David Keene, here, this happens every time we talk about this. The callers profess all kinds of skepticism and concern. It doesn't exactly jive with the details of the legal argument, or maybe it does, but they want that broad, clear line. Do you think we're going to end up with that in this debate over the Patriot Act?
I don't know how clear the line is going to be, but I think it's going to be much clearer than it is at present. The Attorney General, in his testimony today, specifically in regard to that section of the Act, said that the Justice Department has tried to maintain certain limits and to make clear what their position is, but acknowledged that the Act doesn't make that clear. I suspect that when the Act is reauthorized, it will make it clear. That there will be some clearly defined procedures and limits that are not in there right now. I think this argument that it's simply a choice between security and liberty is not necessarily correct. We can have both. I don't think there is anybody that really believes that we ought to leave ourselves defenseless in the face of terrorism or terrorists or an external enemy. At the same time, there has, and as was pointed out in previous wars and in this conflict, what you have to do is find ways of protecting yourself without changing the nature of the society that we're protecting. In the days right after 9/11, Don Rumsfeld made the point that if we change the nature of our society in response to the terrorists, that means that they won. And I think what this review is about is to make sure that we protect ourselves, but that we do so in a way that doesn't change the nature of the greatest society that's ever developed on this earth.
Well, we will be following that right throughout this year as Congress does its long review. David Keene, Chairman of the American Conservative Union, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Heather McDonald, we're out of time, but we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Heather McDonald, a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Jack Beatty, please stick with us. This is On Point. One of a group of acclaimed post-World War II American Jewish writers, Saul Bellow, died today at his home in Brookline, Massachusetts. He was 89. Born to Russian immigrants in Quebec, Canada, he moved with his family to Chicago at the age of 9. Hebrew was his first language, but as a writer, he made a lasting mark on the English language. In 1954, he won the National Book Award for The Adventures of Augie March. He went on to win the award two more times, the first writer to accomplish such a feat. In 1976, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Humboldt's Gift, and then came the Nobel Prize. Novelist, editor, and professor of journalism at Boston University, Keith Botsford, collaborated with Saul Bellow over 53 years as editor of literary journals, Noble Savage, Anon, and most recently, The Republic of Letters. He joins us from his home in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Keith Botsford, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
And our own our sorrow as well. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. Before we begin, let's hear just a bit of Saul Bellow from an interview he did with you, Keith Botsford.
This is how people have always learned to write interestingly, by yielding to their more conspicuous feelings and convictions.
Saul Bellow in an interview with Keith Botsford. Mr. Botsford, it's a sad day. Mr. Bellow has passed. Your thoughts this evening?
Yes, it's a sad day for literature because it's been some time since he's been able to write. But it's a great release for him from a marvelous mind captive in a body that wasn't functioning and that in which he was not communicating to the world in which he used to.
He was so prominent for so many years that his impact was so enormous. What were his health problems at the end that have now finally led to his death?
He was he took some poisoned fish in St. Martin Island during an ill-timed vacation. He was fed atropine, and he ultimately went into a coma about 6 years ago. I can't remember exactly. From atropine poisoning, and his brain was obviously affected by this some years later. It took 4 or 5 years, but the last 2 years have been very difficult for Saul. He did, however, die, apparently, I'm told, with his eyes wide open for 1 minute, which they hadn't been for at least a year, and looking straight ahead, which is the way he was. He wanted to see everything with a very clear eye, and that's the nature of the man.
We have to remember him as a tremendously vigorous writer. I remember just the almost visceral excitement in reading his books. How would you describe his mark on American literature, Keith Botsford?
He did two marvelous things. He recreated the American language with his particular idiom, which came from many other parts of the world, and a great tradition. And the other thing that he did was he was the great noticer of absolutely everything, the most intelligent and wide-open, observant man I have ever known or ever expect to know.
Jack Beatty, opening a book by Saul Bellow was an act of pure excitement just from the get-go.
Let me open one.
Yes, please.
These are the first sentences of The Adventures of Augie March. I am an American, Chicago-born, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way. First to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes a not-so-innocent. But a man's character is his fate, says Heraclitus, and in the end there isn't any way to disguise the nature of the knocks by acoustical work on the door or by gloving the knuckles.
Oh, gosh, it doesn't get better than that. Jackie, you've read Saul Bellow over the years. Just talk about a big stamp. This is as big as it gets.
Well, you know, Philip Rov wrote a famous essay called Pale Face and Redskin, in which he divided American writers up into those categories. Pale faces, refined writers, idea writers, Henry James, Redskins, Mark Twain. The thing, Saul Bellow was both a pale face and a redskin. He was at once the intellectual, the writer of ideas. All the ideas just live on every page, and of vitality. He could present people who were, you know, all caught up in ideas like Herzog, but also who are just sort of whose lives are inadequate to this, and show the vital mess of people's lives next to these the really bogus factitious clarity of ideas. There just was more life in him and more range in him than probably any writer of the modern age. I mean, Philip Roth could be compared, but there isn't in Roth the voice that you have in Bellow, that idiomatic Chicago-born voice.
Keith Botsford, you knew Saul Bellow for many years, half a century nearly. Over half a century. How did you see, we've just got a minute left and there's so much more to say, but how did you see his perspective on life changing, not after his health problems at the end, but in the last decade, let's say?
I think he grew more and more refined in mind. He abandoned some of his early amplitude, as was just said rightly. He was a tremendous man day to day. His speech was extraordinary. He was forever cracking. He said very recently, you know, somewhere that he had been pushing against the turnstile of death for a long time, and soon it would let him in, and that's what happened today. He was just the most observant of men and a marvelously physical describer of the universe around him and of people. He didn't like intellectuals. He didn't like to futz around with ideas. The great thing about him is that his ideas are contained in a human voice, accessible to everyone. He was the most democratic writer that we have ever had, and that is a very special qualification, and it's an example to every writer in the world.
An American, Chicago-born, Saul Bellow, dead today at 89. Keith Botsford, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Jack Beatty, wonderful to have you as always. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.